California Senate Bill 620 would, if signed into law, make it legal for the state's residents to buy liquor directly from a local distiller. Thought of that legal liquor leads us to ask, should one be allowed to buy liquor from a local distiller, or should one be forced to buy liquor from the oligarchs of the state?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1303rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned into the podcast on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. There is a last frontier in the ongoing struggle by those who think local first for food sovereignty, legal local liquor. But before we drink up on the thought, let's have a look at this notion of food sovereignty, which simply put, is a food system in which the people who produce, distribute, and consume food also control the mechanisms and the policies of food production and distribution. Food sovereignty is buying and selling food at the farmer's market. Food subservience is buying food from far away at the big box store. One food, if one dare call it that, for which people have become almost totally subservient is liquor. Though George Washington once freely distilled the grain of his farm into liquor and sold it to whomever he wished, today the trade is most always controlled by the government and its oligarch liquor traders. If one wants if one wants a drink of whiskey, one must bow down to the state and its oligarchs. But there is an innate desire for freedom within us all, and what better place to fight for that freedom than on the battleground of food and drink? And so those who love their sovereignty fight for the right to buy and sell food and drink with their neighbors. Being among those who love freedom, we look with interest to the possibility of legal local liquor and ask, should one be allowed to buy liquor from a local distiller, or should one be forced to buy the liquor from the state and its oligarchs? Who better to ask than the man who will most certainly say yes? That would be David Bloom, who is the farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and proprietor of Bloom Distillation. David, welcome back.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Michael, and I'll add to my accolades there, Slayer of Oligarchs.
Slayer of Oligarchs. You're the man, then. Well, good. Now, is alcohol a food?
Well, I would think so. You know, when you think about corn out there, 90% of it is fed to cows, and maybe 3% is made into modified food starch. And then, you know, of course, there's some other minor uses, but 1% of corn is definitely made into whiskey, and I do consider that food.
Value added.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so do you think we should be able to buy and sell liquor from each other?
Well, you know, in most of the world, it's not so prevalent that governments and traders control the liquor industry. Like in New Zealand, anybody's allowed to have a little still at home and make their own. But here in America, we have a long history that goes otherwise.
What about Russia? I think of, you know, the great love for drinking vodka. Is that all controlled by the state too, do you know?
It's only at the very big scale. The small scale people are still allowed to make their own, but you know, alcohol is a pretty good pacifier for the population. So
right,
you know,
here have another one, please.
But one of the things I like about Russia, and you've been out to my farm, Michael, you know that we grow cattails, that, you know, very familiar marsh plant. Well, it has very starchy roots. And in Russia, they make alcohol from cattail roots, and they're imitating the Roman Empire that used to give little flasks of cattail alcohol in the weekly salary that Roman soldiers got. And the word salary comes from salt, because you got your weekly salt with your little ration kit, along with your flask of cattail hooch.
Well, and when it gets right down to the history of mankind, you can pretty much see that alcohol plays a big part in it all the way back to the very beginnings. I was recently pointed to a photograph of a, I guess, a mummified person in a grave in China.
Yes.
And it was dated back 9,000 years. And there next to him was a jug for his booze right there, 9,000 years ago. So it's been with us a long, long, long time.
Well, and you know, the other thing about that booze is that it was still good. In other words, alcohol has an infinite shelf life because, as we all know, alcohol kills bacteria. And of course, it even kills viruses like COVID.
There you go.
But, you know, only if you rub it on the surface, not when you drink it.
There you go. Well, so that's something has been with us for so long. But before we go to this, I'd like to get a very quick history of Whiskey Hill Farm, because in Freedom, California, because I guess it's almost like an icon of food sovereignty when it gets right down to it. Whiskey Hill Farm, because it once was a Whiskey Hill.
Well, yes, actually the town of Freedom, which is you know, a recent name actually, used to be called Whiskey Hill. And it was a collection of bordellos and bars along Coralitos Creek originally. But the liquor was made up the hill where my farm is and going to the west of me, which was covered with redwoods and nice place to hide your still. And so that was called Whiskey Hill. And after Prohibition, which I'm sure we'll talk about, the town fathers, the 10 of them, got together, and I've talked with some of their progeny, and they tell me about the story, which is that they got together to change the name of the town. And so going from Whiskey Hill, one guy said, well, let's call it Susanville, because, well, his wife was named Susan. And they said, no, 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 none of that. You know, and another guy tried to name it Juliet after his wife, because he didn't get the memo on the first one. And so after wrangling quite a bit, they finally said, look, the way we keep the spirit of Whiskey Hill, spirits in general, but let's be sanitize it a bit. And so we'll call it Freedom, because, you know, you had every kind of wild person there. There used to be, you know, bullfights there, and, you know, they'd be watched by, you know, the floozies from the bar and the cowboys and the loggers. And, you know, it's a wild town that Santa Cruzans would go out to in their carriages to get a little taste of the outlaw life.
So now I'm really curious about you, because you're the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which is the great story about how alcohol can be used to power an economy, our cars, our trucks, our airplanes, everything.
Electricity.
Electricity. Yes. And so I'm curious about you. Did you move to Whiskey Hill Farm because of that history of alcohol, or did you buy a farm on Whiskey Hill Farm, and did that transform you into becoming an aficionado of alcohol?
Well, I already was an aficionado of alcohol, but you know, I was focusing on things that really help our environment. You know, by using alcohol to replace petroleum, which made me an enemy of another bunch of oligarchs, you know. Yeah. You know, that's a long, hard battle, and nobody funds you for that. And so, you know, you got to figure out, as a farmer, you always look for the crops that make money. You can't make a living on carrots, okay? So, you know, liquor has a much higher per gallon value than, say, replacement for, well, nowadays, $5 a gallon auto fuel,
you know? Go.
So, you know, at $25 or $30 or $150 a gallon, alcohol as a liquor puts bread on the table. I mean, think about it for a minute. A gallon of pure alcohol is 200 proof. So if you're selling alcohol at about 80 proof, you know, your average whiskey, gin, et cetera, well, you're obviously getting a dilution of that pure gallon of alcohol. And so now you get 13 bottles, fifth of a gallon, out of that gallon. And when you go ahead and sell that, you make a lot more money than putting a gallon of pure alcohol in a gas tank. So we don't have to sell a lot of alcohol to keep our social agenda going, which is creating freedom from the oil companies and from the governments that support them. But, you know, just like any do-gooder organization, you need to have a, you know, a solid income from a business activity.
Amen. And speaking of one of those do-gooders way back in time, I think his name was George Washington. And he was very good at adding value to his carrots and other farm crops, right?
Well, George Washington was someone who did good and he did very well, you know, and he was the biggest distiller in the United States. Now, even before there was a constitution, you know, it took us 12 years to get the constitution after we won our revolution.
Took a lot of lubrication to get that job done.
Yes, indeed, you know, and so basically when, you know, the whole time during the Revolutionary War, people were making alcohol locally. And, you know, all of us were guerrilla fighters against the British and all that. And so we were really thrilled to have our own country. And then Washington, well, he tried to pay the Revolutionary War bills, you know, weapon sales cost a lot of money. And the rich landowners on the East Coast said, property tax? No way. We're the rich. We don't pay taxes. Sound familiar?
Yes,
so,
it does.
Yeah, so they said, let's tax alcohol and that'll pay for all the weapons. And so that's what they did. And here's all these revolutionary fighters who were out there in the bushes shooting at the British, making liquor in their little town, saying, wait a minute, this isn't what we fought for. We fought for freedom. And so they continued to make alcohol. Well, Washington sent an army out to 20,000 men out to the Monongahela Valley in Pennsylvania to try to suppress all this alcohol making without taxes, because they tar and feather tax collectors and drag them through town, you know. And,
right.
Well, that couldn't be allowed. So they looked all around for the distillers and they couldn't find them because they were guerrilla fighters in the war. They all had distilleries hidden out in the mountains. So that's where they had to stay. And so they became known as white Indians. In other words, Indians were the evil. They were the Arabs of the early part of our country, you know, where people had to demonize somebody.
Sure.
And so then they became known as moonshiners because they could only make their liquor at night by the light of the moon. And so that's where the term moonshiners come from, and that's where illicit alcohol has come from forever. And we're about to become licit today when the Senate votes.
So, well, as we speak, to give us a real, we have 1 minute before the break, but give us a quick thumbnail of this Senate bill that's pending today in California.
Well, basically, it'll allow a distillery to sell alcohol liquor directly to a member of the public. You know, basically, you couldn't send a bottle by mail. You couldn't even sell bottles, except if you had a restaurant at the distillery, you know, an unnecessary restriction to sell a bottle of liquor to a customer. So basically, liquor makers had to go through a whole Byzantine system of distributors who had a lock on the market and could set prices that they'd pay distillers.
Oligarchs.
Monopoly. You
there
know.
You go.
There it is.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and the book itself is a gas, so find it and read it if you'd like to learn about alcohol and its various uses. And today we're asking the question, should one be allowed to buy liquor from a local distiller, or should one be forced to buy liquor from the state and its oligarchs? Right back.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, yes, What's Drinking What today is we are thinking about the having the ability, gaining the ability in California here at least, of being able to go out to a distiller's distillery. And I'm thinking personally of going out to Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California, and being able to buy two fingers of great whiskey from David Bloom, the distiller, and taking that glass of whiskey out in front and sitting in an old chair and leaning up against the barn door and looking out over the fields and sipping that whiskey, and or even just ordering some from him and having it shipped FedEx to my front door and sitting out in my backyard, but having the freedom to be able to buy liquor,
local
liquor.
Yeah.
And without having to go through the government or its oligarchs. Wow, that's freedom.
Well, it is. And you know, if you go back into a little bit of history, because as you know, Michael, I've been an advocate for running our cars on alcohol instead of that black oily stuff that comes from the Middle East. And it turns out that prohibition was instituted by a well-known oil man called Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
He paid the Women's Christian Temperance Movement $4 million to go out and pass prohibition, which would take his competition for auto fuel off the market. At that time, half the cars ran on alcohol and half ran on gasoline.
And so farmers had the ability to run either way, whichever was available, because gasoline was hard to find in a lot of places.
Yeah, and actually there were chains of gas stations. The Agrol Company was one of them that was all farmer-owned. It went up and down the Mississippi with stations that sold alcohol for farm tractors and for everybody's cars. And, you know, the oil companies spread a rumor that Agrol wasn't really buying grain from farmers. It was importing cheap molasses from the Caribbean, and people abandoned the brand within a month and broke the company. So dirty tricks between the government, oil companies, and farmers is an old story.
Old story. You know, we look back at the time of the Volstead Act, and it was a time of a lot of perfection movements, as they called them, I believe. And temperance was one of them, and prohibition. So I think of Carrie Nation and her axes going into saloons and busting up kegs of beer and whatnot with her axe. And so somehow they talked the entire country into this notion that we should prohibit alcohol. That must have been more than just Carrie Nation doing that.
Well, Carrie Nation and her, you know, little cadre of women took that $4 million from Rockefeller and went into Congress and bought every politician with the money. And each politician thought, oh, this will never pass. You know, I'll vote for it and get my big chunk of money. But certainly, you know, most of my colleagues won't vote for it. And they did. And so basically, they were all embarrassed the next day. And it took, maybe you know, Michael, 13, 14 years, something like that, before we overturned the oiligarch's, law against alcohol, because it didn't stop drinking. People just went back to small stills and farms all over the place. And,
right. You
know, and so the government wasn't getting its taxes. And so they reversed prohibition because they wanted the taxes.
But it was an amendment. It was the 18th Amendment.
To the Constitution. So it took two-thirds vote by Congress to pass it, which is unbelievable, the power of money to make that happen.
Yeah. And that's what we see happening today as well. It hasn't changed much when
No.
it gets right down to it. And yet we still have this freedom. So given that impetus of the control, how did the control coalesce, as it almost always does, in the hands of government and its oligarch business people?
Well, you know, when you have a mandate from the government, then big business steps in to take advantage of that and impose its will on the market and people. So by saying that a distiller was unable to give a customer their product, but had to instead sell it through a Byzantine maze of distributors, those distributors then had a monopoly on the market of selling alcohol. So even today, a distributor will take a 60% cut off of retail when buying the alcohol from a distiller. And then there's other people, sub-distillers down the way, that take other chunks. So a farmer or a farmer distiller like myself would be lucky to make maybe a dollar per fifth of alcohol out of that $30, you know, at the cash register. So, you know, once again, the farmer gets the short end of the stick, and the distiller, as the agent of the farmer, gets even less.
Or it's not really as the agent of the farmer, it's really the agent of the government, right?
Well, yes. The agents of the government are the ones that control the market.
Yeah.
And so this is, there are four other states that have already passed this. Once California, as we have, will pass it today, actually, you know, here on the 31st, then what happens is everyone follows California, and we would expect freedom to break out amongst many states.
Which would be a major big deal for the ag community all through, across the land. But take us back. Let's look at what happened with the regulations when the Volstead Act was repealed, because that was a federal government rule. That was the feds.
Yes.
And the feds say, okay, it's over. What happened then?
Well, there was an explosion of activity, but very quickly the rulemakers at the Treasury Department, or what used to be called the ATF, you know, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, you know, went ahead and said, well, to collect taxes, we can't let it be unregulated where farmers could just sell to their neighbors because, well, they could sell for cash and they could not collect the tax. So that was the reason for the instituting of separation of church and state, as they say in alcohol, where the producer couldn't be the seller. And so, you know, that's when almost immediately after ending prohibition, they created the system where the profit would be made by the friends of the guys in government, these big corporations.
Oligarchs.
The oiligarchs or oligarchs, yes.
There you go. Now, the states took it upon themselves, too, to get into the action, correct?
Because, well, you know, it's a good place to have taxes. If you're already paying federal taxes and you have to sell your product, well, the state jumps in and does the same, although far less punitively than the federal government. I mean, the tax on alcohol was almost 20, I think it still is, over 20-something dollars a gallon on pure alcohol, or about 10.50 on what's called the proof gallon, or 50% alcohol. So that, Ronald Reagan at one point wanted to do a very radical thing. He said we should abolish the tax on alcohol because the bureaucracy to collect the tax was $10 out of the $10.50 that was being charged. The government was only making 50 cents on a proof gallon of alcohol, but paid an enormous number of people to enforce that law because alcohol is really slippery.
And interestingly enough, this was the same era in which cannabis was prohibited as well.
You know, they perfected prohibition on alcohol, and then I guess it was the 30s when they just repeated the same thing.
Yeah.
They demonized the substance, you know, like they remember demon rum was the saying with carrying nations. And so they demonized marijuana and then prohibited it. So it was the same corporate playbook that worked for alcohol. They did the same thing for cannabis. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The big dogs, the oligarchs that were partially behind that was DuPont making synthetic rope material. And hemp was the, you know, hemp rope was
right.
Excellent, excellent rope. And so it was cheap to make. Farmers made it. And they didn't, they couldn't compete with the farmers, so they had it prohibited primarily by demonizing the whole plant as a drug, and hemp couldn't be made into rope anymore.
There you go. So everything's bad, but we'll allow you a little bit of it if you follow our rules. You call the rules Byzantine. What does that mean?
Well, you know, in Byzantium, long time ago, there were many, many layers of bureaucracy to do anything. It was one of the, it's kind of a synonym of the invention of bureaucracy, where the government hires tons of people to enforce contradicting and difficult to understand regulations. And so the alcohol business is like that. I can't tell you what I've had to go through just to get my licenses for even making alcohol as an auto fuel. And I actually was part of the fight to even make that legalized back in the early 80s. And well, it's a good story because I and three guys sat down together with, you know, a lot of beer. And we went through all the documents about alcohol, which you used to be able to order from the federal government. We used to have this wonderful thing called the government printing office. So you could get any regulation or law in paper delivered to you for free by the government, like any democracy should. So we had a 3-foot-tall stack of paper to go through that were the regulations for alcohol. We figured there's got to be a loophole here somewhere. So we were going through.
But talk about Byzantine. The 3-foot stack of rules and regulations would make anything Byzantine then.
So we went through that sheet at a time, and finally, halfway down, I said, I got it. It was the experimental distiller's permit, which the big corporations had so they could shortcut a lot of Byzantium to be able to do something new. Oh. And so I went ahead and applied for the permit, and oh my gosh, I got it. And so I folded it up and put it back in my pocket, and then I called the ATF and said, hey, we're out here making alcohol. Ha, 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 ha. Next day, like, you know, flak jackets, automatic weapons, they come out, they arrest me, they put handcuffs on me and take me to jail. So the next day when I'm being arraigned, the judge said, well, this seems open and shut, Mr. Bloom. You have a distillery, so you must intend to make alcohol, and that's against the law. And I said, well, Your Honor, I'd like to argue that. And he goes, well, where's your lawyer, Mr. Bloom? I said, no, I think I can handle this myself, Your Honor. He goes, I don't want any funny business in my court. You know, no levity here. So I said, no, I have a precedent, Your Honor. He goes, well, what precedent is that? And I said, well, there was a young chemist in England who was doing experiments, and he built a distillery to make alcohol for his experiments. And the taxing authorities came and arrested him. And when he went before the magistrate, like I'm here today before you, the judge said, well, you have a still, and so you must be guilty. And he said, well, why? And he says, because you have the equipment in your possession. And he said, well, then I want to confess to another crime. And the judge says, what other crime? And he said, rape. And the judge says, my God, did you rape somebody? He goes, no, but I have the equipment in my possession. So in that point, in modern time, I had the bailiff pull the permit out of my back pocket because I was still handcuffed in front of the judge. And they brought it up to the judge, and the judge looked at it and says, great Scott, this man has a license for doing this. And I said, you know, yeah, take these handcuffs off. I'm leaving. And I did. Well, you know, we were during a gas crisis at this point, right. You know, and farmers are saying we want to make...
That's when, Nixon mandated everybody drive no faster than 55 miles an hour.
Yeah, to save gas. But, you know, that saving gas is one thing, but it was such a shortage with the gas crisis. So farmers start saying we can make alcohol to run cars. They used to run on them. They'll run on them again. It's really easy. And so I went up before George McGovern in a Senate committee about this. And the head of the ATF was on the table next to me. And George McGovern said, well, this man has a permit to make alcohol, and you're trying to stop him from doing it every which way you can. And Mr. Bloom is a patriot. He's trying to save us from Arab domination with oil. What do you have to say about this? And the guy from the ATF went, oh, well, I'm just following the rules, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's no real, you know, official permit. You know, he got a little experimental permit. I said, well, Senator McGovern, I just happen to have written up a document here that looks pretty good. I think it could be the permit for, you know, people to make their own alcohol. And so they showed it to him, and he looked at it, and the ATF guy looked at it, and McGovern said, well, what about it? This looks like it would give you all the the documentation you need. And the poor guy was just snowballed, and George McGovern pushed through the laws that allowed us to make alcohol for fuel, and quite a bit of it.
Which is now very big business.
Oh, it is.
Huge business, because a huge percentage of the corn in the Midwest is now, goodness sakes, the time flies. And so now it's alcohol that one might drink.
Well, it's, yes, and that's the new thing. The alcohol for fuel, you know, is made by the corn growers out there. But it's a commodity, just like corn is. It's very cheap, and so you're making very small amount of money, and your only customer are the oil companies to mix it with gas. So if we want to make money, we got to make something people buy, and nothing like mankind's second oldest profession of making alcohol to, you know, have a market.
And not only that, but having the ability to make legal local liquor for your friends and neighbors and community members who would like to have a sip of something very local from somebody they know, and they can look in your eyes and see what's in the liquor, rather than buying it from the big box store where they have to check your mark of the devil and see if you're legal enough to buy.
Or on the day of the week. Some places still have Sunday closures.
There you go, yeah. So, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And today we're talking about a California effort to allow David to sell his distilled spirits directly to people. Anywhere in California, people would be able to call up David and say, David, please send me a fifth of such and such. And
as long as they're over 21.
Okay. And when we come back, we're going to ask the question, should one be allowed to buy liquor from a local distiller, or should one be forced to buy the liquor from the state and its oligarchs? Right back.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. BusinessMoneyToGo.com.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, the prospects for legal local liquor, at least here in California, are very bright today, because in Sacramento today, as we speak, they're going to be passing Senate Bill 620, which, if signed into law, would make it legal for the state's residents to buy directly from a local distiller like David Bloom here, who makes his whiskey at Whiskey Hill Farms in Freedom, California, which is a good place to make legal local liquor. David, who's against it? I mean, who is against our food and drink sovereignty?
Well, it's the people who currently have the monopoly. They made lots of arguments and spread a lot of money around saying that basically, people would be making all this alcohol that would be in the population, and we'd have all these alcoholics, and the state wouldn't get its taxes. And, you know, we distributors defend the state by collecting those taxes, you know. So really, it was about economics, you know, like mm-hmm. most things are.
Just keep your hands off our money.
That's right. And so, our being able to sell directly to people means we get to keep the whole retail amount. It's like having a farm stand.
So this is really going to strengthen farmers and weaken oligarchs.
Well, not only that, but it allows creativity, because the oligarchs only buy certain things, and usually very generic things, you know?
Yeah, so it's probably just like they do food, you know? If you want an apple, you get a red, delicious apple, and that's all.
And here in the county, oh my God, we grow so many different kinds of very cool apples, because we can sell direct to the public at farmers markets and even in some of our more progressive markets around
here. What kind of distilled spirits is possible? What's it possible for you to make at Whiskey Hill Farm?
Well, you know, for thousands of years, you mentioned the Chinese 9,000 years ago, they used alcohol for extracts of plants. Right. Alcohol is a great solvent for all the active ingredients in plants and flavors. So medicine used to be almost exclusively the realm of alcohol extracted plants, you know, those wonderful things that even people nowadays, people like at Blossom's Herb Company over here in Freedom, you know, Watsonville Freedom, they do that right now and sell it to farmers market. All these medicines using alcohol as a solvent for plants. So, you know, when you're talking about using alcohol, there's more to it than just drinking it to get drunk. Or you could combine the two. So, for instance, you know, I grow high-value crops that have a lot of interesting characteristics. So I grow ginger, turmeric, and now wasabi, you know, the Japanese root.
Wasabi liquor. Whoa.
Yeah, so we're going to make a very spicy liquor with those three ingredients, for instance. And it gives us a huge edge, because wasabi sells for $100 a pound in the market because it's so much in demand, and it's the hardest crop to grow anywhere. You'll find it in every book, wasabi's the hardest crop to grow, but, you know, for me, farmer, I can handle it.
Yeah, because you can do it in Freedom, California, and maybe not in Winnemucca.
Well, it's a wonderful weather here. It's mild. And, you know, wasabi lives at the bottom of canyons on the edges of creeks in Japan. That's where it's from. So the amount of direct sun at the bottom of the canyon is limited. And also it's cool, you know, and there's lots of water. So, you know, when you think about the Pacific coast, well, heck, we don't get really, really hot days more than a couple of days a year. And we don't get hard frosts and really cold days. And in that range, just like the bottom of a deep natural canyon, we can recreate those conditions to make wasabi very happy.
Therefore, you, given your unique conditions, can make a very unique liquor.
That's
a legal local liquor, a very special kind of blend that can only be essentially purchased from Whiskey Hill Farms. And probably many other farmers can do the same thing, which is to capture the essence of where they're at, their terroir.
That's right.
As it is. And make something that's truly unique and special. And so in so doing so, enrich the community's tastes. And think of what people can talk about.
That's right.
As they sip their whiskey with their friends, they can talk about this whiskey and that whiskey and this farmer and that farmer. And in doing so, you really build a local economy.
Yeah, well, our distillery is small, and we don't expect really to sell alcohol in any great way outside of the three-county area. That's where we want to support. There might be some mail orders from other places, but they'd have to hear about us. So, you know, we are talking about some spicy liquor, and there's a few out there like Fireball that uses cinnamon. But, you know, there are many, many flavorful plants like shiso, which is prized in Japanese cooking and has a wonderful flavor in rum.
And because there are those people who have this very special relationship with the government, whatever government happens to be in control, because they have that special relationship with the government, local farmers are not allowed to make their special liquors. The only liquor that is essentially right now being allowed to be made is that comes from these giant companies that have this special relationship with the government. How did you break that incredible? That's like making a nuclear bomb blow up or something. You have to split the atom. How did you do that?
Well, it took a lot of work by a lot of people to push for this. It took several years to get this legislation passed. But, you know, along that comment you made about the big companies having a limited number of offerings, one of the things is if you're not big enough to supply, you know, all of the America or all of the state with some kind of new liquor, you can't, because you can't make enough for them to go ahead and market it. So, you know, if you want unusual liquors, you know, made from things like I'm talking about, of local herbs, you know, and other really flavorful things that, you know, you might find in, you know, other countries where they have small distilleries, we now can do that. In fact, craft distillers can now sell bottles of their unusual liquors to businessmen in Japan for $250 a bottle, because it's all about bragging rights.
Right.
And at Whiskey Hill Farms, yes. You know, we want bragging rights. We want people to share with their friends the super delicious stuff we're going to be making, and not just the...
Yeah, and that's the essence of the metropolitan consumer. I mean, what do people in cities want most? That which their neighbor can't get, right?
Well, that's
for humans.
Oh,
look at this tomato I got. It's so incredibly precious. Man, it's
vine
ripened, organic, dry farmed heritage, blah, 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 blah.
And boy, taste it and you know the difference.
Yeah. And
well, our liquor is organic. We're currently, because we've been doing experiments for years with our distilleries, business. And not selling liquor, you know, until we get our legal license. We've been using organic molasses from South America, which is not perfectly local, but it's temporary. And so we're making organic hooch. There's only a sprinkling of organic liquors on the market. But think about all the petrochemicals that are on crops, you know, grapes, et cetera, and that when you distill that stuff, it comes over in the liquor, and so you're drinking the weird chemicals that are used in conventional agriculture.
So it doesn't disappear?
No, they have a high boiling point, and they don't wash, you know, water doesn't wash them off. They're oil, you know, oil products.
Right.
So when you distill, the boiling points are within the range for boiling and making, you know, boiling is the process that we vaporize the alcohol, and with it, many of the chemicals come along with it into conventional liquors. So, you know, I think over time, the awareness will be, I don't want to drink that conventional stuff for my health.
It'll
want to drink
like
organic.
All of the rest of the food now. You go to even the big box store, it's hard to find conventional food in the big box store anymore because there's so much organic food being offered now.
And, you know, it's a characteristic of our local culture. We're well informed because we're in the vegetable breadbasket, you might say, of the world. And we know the difference between local, tasty, organic food and the commercial stuff that you might get at Costco that's not organic, that, you know, you're looking at turnips that you could use for baseball practice. You know, I mean, they have no flavor, you know. And so so we can...
Well, and all the rest of those places in the world could be growing those turnips that don't taste like baseballs, too. They could be doing it.
Yes.
If they did it locally, they could do so much more. And I guess that's the essence of what we're looking at today is the wonderful freedom that we could enjoy if we just took that freedom back from those that don't want us to have it.
Well, I'll drink to that. Well, you know what they say, you know, in good times people drink and in bad times they drink more. So I'd call it, you know, an essential food for well-being in tough times.
So what exactly does this California law say, and what will it allow you to do, and how do you see the market growing?
Well, as the local market for food is limited but growing all the time, it'll be the same way, because once you cross 150,000 gallons, then you have to sell it through distributors. So it's not a wide open busting open the liquor business, but it's a wedge that we've put into it that allowed local production and enough production where we can actually make a profit as a good business and be able to have longevity in our local areas. So it allows us to sell the liquor directly to the public. It allows people to...
it allows you to make a living, or you're not going to get rich, but you get rich compared to digging ditches, I guess.
Well, like the county, you know, when they considered our request to be able to have a distillery on our property, you know, limits were important. They didn't want a manufacturing business, a big company out on farmland. So they gave a rational and reasonable limit where farmers could make a living doing this, grow the crops that they're distilling. We're going to grow sugarcane at Whiskey Hill Farm because there's a few varieties that actually will work in the California climate. I used to work doing research with the Agricultural Research Service, and one of their little tiny experiments was non-tropical sugarcane. So I'll be able to make something called cachaça, which is not made from molasses, which is how rum is made. Mm-hmm. Cachaça is made from the juice of the sugarcane, not after they take the sugar out, the white sugar out of the sugarcane. So the flavor is herbal and...
So you throw the whole thing in... We cook it.
And we juice the whole sugar cane and then
take us through the process. You got sugar cane growing here in Freedom, California.
That's right. So we press the sugar cane, and there are small presses around the world. There are small sugar operations. So we get the juice, and it's got enough sugar in it because, well, heck, it's sugar cane. So we can ferment it, which means we sterilize it to kill any bacteria. We put it in tanks, add yeast, same yeast that make wine and beer or bread. And the yeast eat the sugar and excrete the alcohol and carbon dioxide, which we use in the greenhouses to help our plants grow. The carbon dioxide is plant food. And then once we have about 12% alcohol from the work of the yeast, sugar cane wine, we then distill it like wine into brandy, which is you heat the wine until the alcohol vaporizes and does it in stages until it gets up to the strength you want. And most of the flavors are esters and ketones and stuff that come with the alcohol as it vaporizes, giving the liquor the flavor that it wants if you don't overcook it. Now, the big guys, they're, you know, they don't care. They just go full blast and remove all the flavors that could be in the liquor. And it's very neutral alcohol that is kind of boring, you know, in the bottles. But us, we can tailor our heating and vaporizing so that we capture, as you said, the terroir, the essences of our local plants and make unique flavors and add to it crop plants that we grow, like I mentioned, shiso and other leafy plants that have wonderful volatile smells, flowers we can put in. I mean,
it would be like being in the amusement park, like going to Disneyland. My goodness, what freedom. David Bloom, do you think this is going to lead to a renaissance of small-scale agriculture?
It could, because small-scale agriculture has a hard time because it does. The big guys only want to pay a little bit of money for crops because
commodities.
They want to make everything a commodity. And so, you know, like I grow turmeric, right? So, you know, in the big, markets, it's $18, $19 a pound. I only get $8 a pound for it, and it takes a whole year to grow. So it's not like lettuce where I can get 8 or 9 crops in a year. So, you know, small farmers need something that is worth more money. Just like George Washington. And, you know, it allows us to grow the other crops that are so yummy. If we have a couple that we can make money on, we can afford to grow the things we love to grow, like jelly melons and, you know, carrots and, you know, green onions and
things
stuff.
Things that make life interesting.
Yes, but we have to afford to be able to farm. And so having some value-added products, like in this case, alcohol. In other cases, maybe it's jam, or maybe in other cases, maybe it's a tomato sauce.
And on and on and on.
And we have community kitchens in Watsonville that
there
we can make this stuff.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's David Bloom, Whiskey Hill Farms, Freedom, California. Alcohol can be a gas. David, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.